This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We saw a recent article in the Wall Street Journal. It was headlined, "The Politicization of Motherhood." And the article was about a new book by author and psychoanalyst Erica Commissar. The book's called Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. And in it, Commissar makes some controversial claims. She says that American society deprioritizes motherhood, that many women put their own self-interest above their children's well-being. And most alarming, Commissar writes that she believes, quote, an increase in the incidence of mental illness in children is connected to the increasing disinterest of mothering in our society. Well, then, the article got even more provocative, at least for me. Commissar is a self-described New York liberal. She says Fox News and Christian radio stations have interviewed her and loved her. And then she told the Journal, I couldn't get on NPR. Well, Erica Commissar joins us now from New York. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
I want to say officially welcome to Boston's NPR station.
Thank you to NPR.
Okay, so let's start there. That's a pretty triggery statement. So, like, why is it that you said you think that you couldn't get on NPR?
Well, the book came out about 6 months ago, and it was being published by Penguin, and it really wasn't reviewed by a number of the liberal media outlets. And NPR, which actually would have interviewed me, I think, you know, chose not to, none of the shows. And again, I think the title of the book provokes a lot of, as you say, a lot of controversy. But if you actually read the book itself is rather nuanced and calls for the prioritization of motherhood rather than working versus staying at home, which I think is what people assume when they hear the title.
Okay. Now, I can't speak for the decisions that NPR in Washington makes because we're here in Boston, but I am glad to speak with you about your book. I read it cover to cover, and there are aspects of it which I agree with, aspects of it which I would like to question you on. So you're ready for the Radio Boston treatment?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So first of all, this claim that you say that mothers who devalue, deprioritize, neglect their mothering, that they're putting their children at increased risk for social, emotional, and behavioral well-being problems later in life. I mean, that's an enormous burden to be putting on already burdened mothers. Why do you say that?
Well, so I'm a parent guidance expert as well as a psychoanalyst. And over the years of almost being in practice for 30 years, I was seeing an increase in mental disorders in children being diagnosed earlier and medicated earlier. And I was connecting it in my practice to the absence of mothers in those children's lives on a daily basis. And therefore, I started treating those families as such, trying to get mothers to be more present for their children. And it radically changed a lot of the symptomology that I was seeing in the children. And so then I started looking at the research, and the research really goes back 75 years. Attachment research, neuroscience and epigenetics research, which is more recent, and really found that it backed up what I was seeing in my practice, which is that mothers are not just emotionally necessary in the first 3 years to a child's mental health, but are biologically necessary.
Okay, so allow me to challenge that, if I may, because you know, I read I read the whole book, and I paid especially close attention to the chapters where you do cite quite a bit of research, ranging in time from, you know, the mid 80s to more current stuff, epigenetics, studies on different hormone levels in men versus women, and the function that those hormones have on a developing infant's brain and their social development, things like that. The research itself, I don't take any issue with, but my question and concern is that the research does not conclude what you conclude. Right? There's nothing in the research that says that we can then conclusively correlate mothers going to work before age 3 with an increase in mental disorders in young children. I didn't see a single word that said that, except every time you mentioned it, you said, I believe that.
Mm-hmm. So, and you use the word work again. So again, you're also misconstruing the title of the book. It isn't about working versus not working. It's about prioritizing children. And basically, this is what I've been doing for 30 years. So clinically, I could also see this happening. But in addition to clinical evidence, so what we know is that mothers are critical on a biological level for two really important functions. One is that they emotionally regulate children from the outside. After 3 years, children can internalize the ability to regulate their own emotions. What that means is that mothers keep babies' emotions from going too high or too low. They basically, every time a mother soothes the baby in distress, she's regulating that baby's emotions.
And they don't get the same effect from fathers or other primary caregivers?
Well, that's a different question, but I was just, before I do that, let me just tell you the second function that they perform. So emotional regulation is one. The other thing they do is they buffer children from stress from moment to moment. And at the end of that 3-year period, children internalize that feeling of emotional security and safety, and that promotes resilience to stress. You know, there's a lot in the media about resilience to stress. And if we trace back where resilience comes from, it comes from the emotional security that's provided in that interaction with the mother in the first 3 years. So those two really critical functions of emotional regulation and stress buffering are what mothers do in the first 3 years from moment to moment. And in terms of the next question, I will answer that question. I didn't mean to. I just wanted to finish my statement. Fathers and mothers are both critical to children in terms of their development in the first 3 years, but they're not interchangeable. They're not fungible in a sense. In an evolutionary way, fathers and mothers have always performed different functions. Mothers have been the objects of attachment and emotional security, and fathers have been helpers in separation and resilience promoting and exploration, basically helping with separation. So they're both really critical. They're just not exactly the same. So, and the research shows that when mothers nurture and when fathers nurture, they both produce a hormone in the brain called oxytocin. Mm-hmm. And oxytocin has a different impact on a mother's and father's brain in terms of nurturing. And funny enough, it comes from a different part of the brain in mothers and fathers, to just to emphasize that they're not exactly the same. But in mothers, it makes them more sensitive empathic nurturers, meaning they lean into pain. In fathers, it makes them more playfully stimulating, and it makes them more encouraging of exploration and play. So it, even when fathers stay home as nurturers and it produces more oxytocin in their brains, they're still performing more of the function of fathers.
Okay. So, I mean, like I said, I about the specific conclusions of the research that you cite, I don't necessarily disagree with them. I mean, they're measuring levels of oxytocin or vasopressin in men. You also talk about that hormone, or the stress response in infants when their mothers leave the room in terms of cortisol levels, things like that. I don't take any issue with that. But what I still can't quite find anywhere in your book is conclusive evidence that those things, changes in those things by the absence of a present mother. I take your point about work versus not, perhaps not being the issue, but a present mother, that is conclusively leading to mental health disorders in young children or preteens. And the reason why I say this is because I didn't see anywhere in your book acknowledgement that the rise in these diagnoses could be for any other possible reason, that we're just diagnosing more, we have a lower societal tolerance for normal behaviors in children, maybe there's environmental stuff. I mean, I just had someone on the show not that long ago, a couple months ago, who said she firmly thought that the scientific literature said it was cell phones that are leading to this problem. So there's no acknowledgement of that.
So there is research in the book. You just may have missed it. So I'll ask you to go back and look at it. But there's research from Jay Belsky, who did research on children who were in more than 20 hours of non-maternal care a week in the first year, that it led to more aggression in school age years and more behavioral problems. And also the huge national study that was done on daycare and whether daycare was viable was a very flawed study. But what did come out of it was that there was more signs of aggression and behavioral problems in children who spent too many hours a week in daycare. So there is research in the book. You just have to look for it.
Well, no, but I guess what I'm saying is that you are painting a very broad brush, though. I mean, you open the book by saying talking about ADHD, talking about depression, violence, bullying, all of these things. And then you say, why is this happening to our children? And then
So the analogy that I'll use is of the three little pigs. I always use this, which is that if you build a house of bricks, meaning if you provide a foundation for that child of emotional security, it basically builds a house that can withstand the storms to come. And life is filled with storms. It's filled with challenges for children. It's filled with conflicts, and some are real and environmental. And so, you know, if you build that house of bricks, that house is more likely to withstand the storm. If you build a house of hay or wood, meaning if you don't give your child the best chance of being emotionally secure, which we do understand is related to that moment-to-moment interaction with the mother in the first 3 years, in the first 1,000 days, you know, the child is going to be less resilient to those stressful events in their lives. So, you know, think of me like an epidemiologist who works backwards. So people are asking, where does emotional security come from? Where does resilience to stress come from? You know, we have an increase in emotional regulation problems in children, in adolescents, in adults. That's what depression and anxiety are. They are disorders of emotional regulation, people unable to regulate their own emotions. And if we trace it back, this is the beginning, this is the foundation, and this is where it comes from.
And I mean, other folks out there listening might call that actually selection bias instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, it isn't, because I've seen it in my practice for 30 years. This is all I do every day. So it's not just the scientific and research evidence, it's the clinical evidence. So, and it's also the evidence from having practiced in a way where I address these signs and symptoms by helping mothers to be more present. And as a result, the symptomology changed. So you can call it selection bias, but in truth, it's both clinical evidence and research evidence. It's the science of mothering.
We're speaking with Erica Komisar. Her new book is Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. If you've got some thoughts on the theory and the studies that Erica Komisar points to about the importance of mothering and mothers in the first 3 years of a child's life, and whether or not that's leading, or how our society views mothering is leading to increased incidence of mental disorders or illness in children, let me know. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Erica, if I may, don't take this the wrong way, but I have a question about the fact that, so you come from a psychoanalytic background, and as I read the book, I saw evidence of that in the book as well. And then you mentioned attachment parenting theory, which I saw evidence of as well. There's a healthy representation of those two lines of thinking in the book. But I also wondered how much of this is just, you know, kind of harkens back to good old-fashioned Freudian mother blaming. I mean, that's kind of how the feel that it had. Like, mothers are not doing certain things for their children between the ages of 0 and 3, and so therefore we have all of these problems.
Actually, Freudian psychoanalysis really doesn't talk about before 3. So that would be incorrect. That would be Kleinian, an object relation psychoanalysis.
Okay.
So Freudian psychoanalysis actually really starts talking about development at the Oedipal period, which is why I'm not a strict Freudian. I trained as a Freudian, but I'm actually many things and not just a strict Freudian. And obviously, I believe in a lot of what Freud taught. And many psychoanalysts who followed him built on that and really talked about the earlier years.
Mm. So I'd like you to explore with me or explain a little bit more about how, I mean, you took issue when I said mothers who work. And you said work isn't really the issue. But it's hard not to read how that is part of, you know, what you're saying when, you know, for example, I'm reading page 52 from the book where you say we have a values dilemma in the United States. We focus on giving our children things rather than our time. We don't want to recognize that raising healthy children requires putting their needs ahead of our own for a time, et cetera. So there is the implication, especially to a woman reading the book, as I am, that there is kind of you're making a value judgment about choices that women are making.
Well, again, our country has a problem. We're the only civilized country in the world that doesn't have paid maternity leave. So that already suggests that we don't value mothering and the early relationship between a mother and a child. You know, every other civilized country has some paid maternity leave. So, you know, what I recommend is a year of full paid maternity leave for every woman in America, no matter her socioeconomic background or her ability to to take it, you know. And then another 2 years of flexible and part-time work for those women so they can be as physically and emotionally present. What I say in the book is more is more. So it really isn't a book about working because many women have to work to support their families. Many women are single mothers and have to work. In fact, there's a whole chapter in the book on how if you work, you can still be as present as possible and ways to be as present as possible.
Mm. So just for clarity's sake, and you may have said this earlier, but so forgive me for asking this again, but mm-hmm. in the book, are you saying that in the ideal situation, that it is the mother who would stay home, who would be with the child for the first 3 years as the primary caregiver?
Well, you know, again, mothers and fathers have their unique ways of nurturing. And if fathers are going to be the ones who stay home as primary caregivers, which is what we're seeing more and more, and there's obviously a lot of diversity in family structures today, if a couple comes into my office and says the father is going to be the primary caregiver, then I help that father to be the best mother he can be, meaning to be a sensitive, empathic nurturer and to really lean into the pain as opposed to promote resilience or distract or use play instead of sensitive nurturing. So, you know, many fathers can learn to be sensitive nurturers.
Okay. So in that case, would you agree with what someone like Kimberly Noble, who's a neuroscientist at Columbia, she says that there's no evidence that she knows of that children whose mothers work but who are in loving caregiver relationships, that those children have any detrimental outcomes in terms of achievement or development?
So what I see in my practice is that the children whose mothers are not around enough, they mourn for those mothers. If they have a loving father, they can still grow up to be healthy, but there's a mourning process. And if the mothers who can't be present or don't want to be present don't look at those children and accept the pain that they feel, they can't really repair it. So there's another chapter in the book on how to repair when you are absent. And whether you've gone to the bathroom and you're away for 5 minutes, or whether you've gone out to, you know, go to the gym or the supermarket, or whether you've gone to work for 6 hours, you know, when you come home, it's really important to be able to repair that absence. So think of it like a pull in the sweater. Yeah. If you don't repair that pull in the sweater right away, the hole gets bigger and bigger. So, you know, what I say to mothers is, you know, it's important that we recognize that if someone else is raising our children, even if they're loving caregivers, that our children are still going to have a sense of mourning about not having us as mothers.
So you are talking about the primacy of the maternal bond.
Well, I think mothers are unique, and I'm not ashamed to say that, both as a clinician and having read the research, that mothers have a unique nurturing ability if they're healthy mothers. Now, remember, 1 in 5 women in America are diagnosed with postpartum depression, and I think it's more like 2 in 5 based on my practice and what I see. And so that means we have a lot of mothers who are in a lot of pain, who, you know, may not have had good enough mothering themselves. And so, you know, we're talking about a mother who really is interested in mothering and, you know, is driven to mother and is healthy enough. Yeah, I think mothers are unique.
You know, you don't actually get any disagreement from me on that. I still just, I cannot make the leap from that to saying that mothers not being present is what's causing an enormous increase in mental challenges and social and emotional challenges in children as they get older, because I'm just not seeing there's a paucity of evidence, in my opinion.
Right. So what I see in my practice and what the evidence in the research shows is that there's something called hypervigilance, meaning, remember, mothers buffer children from stress. So when you don't buffer a child from stress, the parts of their brain, there's a little part of the brain called the amygdala, which is like the warning system of the brain.
It's like a light switch. It's one of the most primitive parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a little almond-shaped part of the brain, but it's basically the warning system of the brain that basically tells us we're in a stressful situation and we're under stress. And think of it, if a child doesn't have that buffering from the mother, that alarm system goes off and stays like a light switch, getting stuck in the on position, which leads to what we call hypervigilance. And in hypervigilance, we see the old evolutionary response of fight or flight. So meaning children will either become extremely active, almost distractively active, or will become very aggressive. And those are the symptoms that we're seeing in very young children when they don't have that stress buffering and that emotional regulation.
Hmm. Now, Erica, you may or may not be surprised to know that our lines are full of folks who want to talk with
you. I'm not surprised.
So let's turn to them. Janelle is calling from Somerville. You're on the air, Janelle.
Hi. So I'm calling. I'm a Boston Public Schools teacher, and I'm just sort of wondering. So you're saying I also can't make the leap that I'm hearing from the book. And my question is, so you're saying that if these mothers are not present, you know, children are not as resilient. So I'm wondering what you attribute resiliency in children that don't have present mothers, like many of my students or even my own personal experience. Where are you saying that resiliency comes from?
Janelle, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Janelle. So we have something called defensive independence, which can be formed and shaped very early, meaning if a child isn't buffered from stress, many children will become defensively independent and self-sufficient and seem resilient. And what we're seeing is that many of those children are breaking down later. So they can hold it together and hold it together, and then at some point they break down, whether they break down in adolescence. So the book that I'm working on now is the second period of critical brain development. So we know that 0 to 3 is the first period of brain development, and it is probably the most critical. But if you miss that period of brain development, you have another chance, because adolescence is now 9 to 29, technically. And so that's the second period of critical brain development. And what we know is that if you have a good enough foundation in the first 3 years, adolescence goes easier. And if you don't, there's a good chance that you'll break down in adolescence. So many of those children that she may be seeing that didn't have a present mother may be holding it together with what we call defensive independence.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Jen is calling from Boston. You're on the air, Jen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple of points, and I'm really not trying to place blame on working parents. I think that we have made it quite difficult in the society for a parent to stay home. My career is a nurse, and I'm very fortunate to have worked a lot of off shifts when my kids were little. But I have complete agreement that it is critical for someone, maybe the mother, the father, or loving family member, to be at home with that child the first 3 years. It helps to develop security, self-esteem when they cry or they have a need that needs to be met. To have somebody there to meet that need in an appropriate time frame is so critical. I think look at society today, and the basic question is, are we any better off than we were 20 years ago with the gun violence and the bullying, et cetera, et cetera? And I'll hang up just to listen to your comment. Thank you.
Jen, thank you for your call. Erica, you've got someone there who likes hearing what you're saying.
Oh, there's a lot of people that like hearing what I'm saying. Actually, can I just comment on what she said, because it's so critical?
Absolutely.
And thank you for your comments. So John Bowlby, who's the father of attachment, talked about scaffolding. He said that the first 3 years you build a scaffolding for the child of how they then perceive of the world and relationships for the rest of their lives. If there's someone to soothe them when they're in distress and to meet their needs in those first 3 years, it builds a scaffolding for them, an expectation of how they can depend upon the environment to meet their needs for the rest of their lives, and how they can depend on others, which also says something about the difficulties that young people are having in relationships. So, yeah, that scaffolding is what we build in that first 3 years.
Hmm. Now, you know, since Jen did talk about work, I'm going to bring it back to that for a moment, because I think for many of our listeners right now, the presence versus not presence issue does center around having to return to work. And I want to acknowledge, Erica, that earlier in the conversation, you did say that there are many, many women, especially, who probably don't have a choice for economic reasons, et cetera. And I mean, let's just acknowledge the incredible family stressors that poverty puts on a family, and the detrimental social and emotional effects that just living in poverty has, far more than whether or not a mother is present. But I do want to say that I feel like there are parts of the book, perhaps not what we're hearing from you today, but parts of the book where you do sort of say that women who choose to return to work are prioritizing themselves over their children. I mean, aren't you saying that? For example, you say we're so impatient to return to our, quote, real lives, the one before our children, that we sacrifice our kids' emotional and mental health in the process of rushing back.
Well, what we understand is that babies are born more neurologically fragile than we've ever understood before. That mothers are, for the first 9 months, essentially the central nervous system for babies. And again, if what I'm saying and what the book is saying is that the more is more, the more time you can take off in the beginning, and then the more you can be available both physically and emotionally, even if you work. You know, the best kind of work for a mother is is flexible work and work that's within her control. And many women don't have that kind
Most
of work.
Most women don't have that
kind
of work.
Yeah, exactly. So this book was written for many reasons. One reason was to educate mothers about the importance of mothering and society about the importance of mothering. But it was also written as a document that was meant to withstand the test of time and also to prove that mothers are necessary biologically to children. How else are we going to get a paid maternity leave for mothers for at least a year if there isn't evidence that mothers are unique and biologically necessary to babies? So in a way, we fight ourselves as women when we fight against this concept.
So, but what then do we, how then do we best support the women who don't have a choice? Who's, you know, as you, like right now, short of waving a magic wand, and who knows, this may happen in Massachusetts next year, because voters could actually face a ballot question that asks whether or not the state should levy a tax on employers to support paid family leave for all workers in this state. It might happen here, but short of, but before that, I mean, what can we do if part of the feeling that, I don't know, maybe I'm projecting, Erica, but part of the feeling I come away with is just like you're heaping guilt on women who have to go back
right.
to work.
So you asked two things. One is that guilt for me is not a bad thing. So guilt means that women are in conflict. And when women are in conflict or anyone's in conflict, we don't want to tell people to turn away from their conflicts. As a psychoanalyst, I analyze people's conflicts so they can make better choices in
Erica,
their lives.
I'm terribly, terribly sorry to interrupt. I really
That's
am.
Okay.
But we have the president, President Donald Trump, is speaking right now from the White House, and I have to
sure.
turn to him momentarily.
Sure,
so
here's
the president.
Myself included. With incredible warmth, hospitality, and most importantly, respect. And this great respect showed very well our country is further evidence that America's renewed confidence and standing in the world has never been stronger than it is right now. When we are confident in ourselves, our strength, our flag, our history, our values, other nations are confident in us. And when we treat our citizens with the respect they deserve, other countries treat America with the respect that our country so richly deserves. During our travels, this is exactly what the world saw: a strong, proud, and confident America. Today, I want to update the American people on the tremendous success of this trip and the progress we've made to advance American security and prosperity throughout the year. When I came into office, our country was faced with a series of growing dangers. These threats included rogue regimes pursuing deadly weapons, foreign powers challenging America's influence, the spread of the murderous terror group ISIS, and years of unfair trade practices that had dangerously depleted our manufacturing base and wiped out millions and millions of middle-class jobs. The challenges were inherited, and these products really showed what previous mistakes were made over many years and even decades by other administrations. Some of these mistakes were born of indifference and neglect, others from naive thinking and misguided judgment. In some cases, the negative influence of partisan politics and special interests was to blame. But the one common thread behind all of these problems was a failure to protect and promote the interests of the American people and American workers. Upon my inauguration, I pledged that we would rebuild America, restore its economic strength, and defend its national security. With this goal in mind, I vowed that we would reaffirm old alliances and form new friendships in pursuit of shared goals. Above all, I swore that in every decision, with every action, I would put the best interests of the American people first. Over the past 10 months, traveling across the globe and meeting with world leaders, that is exactly what I have done. Earlier this year, in Saudi Arabia, I spoke to the leaders of more than 50 Arab and Muslim nations about our strategy to defeat terrorists by stripping them of financing, territory, and ideological support, And I urge the leaders to drive out the terrorists and extremists from their societies. Since that time, we have dealt ISIS one crushing defeat after another. In Israel, I reaffirm the unbreakable bond between America and the Jewish state, and I met with leaders of the Palestinian Authority and initiated an effort to facilitate lasting peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. In Brussels, I urged our NATO allies to do more to strengthen our crucial alliance and set the stage for significant increases in member contributions. Billions and billions of dollars are pouring in because of that initiative. NATO, believe me, is very happy with Donald Trump and what I did. In Warsaw, I declared to the world America's resolve to preserve and protect Western civilization and the values we hold so dear. In Rome, Sicily, Hamburg, and Paris, I strengthened our friendships with key allies to promote our shared interests of security and prosperity. In September, at the United Nations General Assembly in New York, I urged that the nations of the world join in confronting rogue regimes that threaten humanity and laid out a model for international cooperation grounded in respect for sovereignty and the responsibilities that come with it. On each trip, I have worked to advance American interests and leadership in the world. And to each of these places, I have carried our vision for a better, a vision for something stronger and sovereign, so important, sovereign and independent nations rooted in their histories, confident in their destinies, and cooperating together to advance their security, prosperity, and the noble cause of peace. It was this same vision that I carried to Asia 2 weeks ago. And it was this same commitment to you, the American people, that was always at the forefront of my mind and my thinking. Our trip was defined by three core goals. First, to unite the world against the nuclear menace posed by the North Korean regime, a threat that has increased steadily through many administrations and now requires urgent action. Second, to strengthen America's alliances and economic partnerships in a free and open Indo-Pacific, made up of thriving independent nations respectful of other countries and their own citizens, and safe from foreign domination and economic servitude. And third, to finally, after many years, insist on fair and reciprocal trade. Fair and reciprocal trade. So important. These two words, fairness and reciprocity, are an open invitation to every country that seeks to do business with the United States. And they are a firm warning to every country that cheats, breaks the rules, and engages in economic aggression, like they've been doing in the past, especially in the recent past. That is why we have almost an $800 billion a year trade deficit with other nations. Unacceptable. We are going to start whittling that down and as fast as possible. With these goals, it was my profound honor to travel on this journey as your representative. I explained to all of the world leaders and across Asia how well the United States is doing. Economic growth has been over 3% the last two quarters and is going higher. Unemployment is at its lowest level in 17 years. The stock market has gained trillions of dollars in value since my election and has reached record highs. We are massively increasing our military budget to historic levels. The House has just passed a nearly $700 billion defense package, and it could not come at a better time for our nation. Once again, our country is optimistic about the future, confident in our values, and proud of our history and a role in the world. I want to thank every citizen of this country for the part you have played in making this great American comeback possible. In Asia, our message was clear and well received. America is here to compete, to do business, and to defend our values and our security. We began our trip in Hawaii to pay our respects to brave American service members at Pearl Harbor and the United States Pacific Command, the guardian of our security and freedom across the Indo-Pacific region. As our country prepared to observe Veterans Day, we remembered the incredible sacrifices and courage of all of the veterans whose service has preserved our liberty and a way of life that is very special. We also thanked military families for their support for our brave servicemen and women. From Hawaii, we traveled to Japan, a crucial U.S. ally and partner in the region. Upon landing in Japan, my first act was to thank the American service members and Japanese self-defense forces who personify the strength of our enduring alliance. Prime Minister Abe and I agreed on our absolute determination to remain united to achieve the goal of denuclearized North Korea. Shortly following our visit, Japan announced additional sanctions on 35 North Korean entities and individuals. Japan also committed to shouldering more of the burden of our common defense by reimbursing costs borne by American taxpayers, as well as by making deep investments in Japan's own military. This will include purchases of U.S. advanced capabilities, from jet fighters to missile defense, systems worth many, many billions of dollars, and jobs for the American worker. Prime Minister and I also discussed ways we can deepen our trade relationship based on the core principles of fairness and reciprocity. I am pleased that since January of this year, Japanese companies have announced investments in the United States worth more than $8 billion, 17,000 jobs. Thank you. They don't have water. That's okay. What? No, it's okay.
You're listening to President Donald Trump. He's speaking at the White House about his 12-day trip to Asia. It looks like he was just taking a quick break to have a quick sip of water. We'll go back to him now shortly.
Between our nations to enhance infrastructure development, increase access to affordable energy, and advance our foreign policy goals through economic investment. From Japan, we traveled to another key American ally in Asia, the Republic of Korea. My official state visit to South Korea was the first by an American president in 25 years. Speaking before the National Assembly of the Republic of Korea, I spoke the truth about the evil crimes of the North Korean regime, and I made clear that we will not allow this twisted dictatorship to hold the world hostage to nuclear blackmail. I called on every nation, including China and Russia, to unite in isolating the North Korean regime, cutting off all ties of trade and commerce until it stops its dangerous provocation on, and this is the whole key to what we're doing, on denuclearization. We have to denuclearize North Korea. We have ended the failed strategy of strategic patience, and as a result, we have already seen important progress, including tough new sanctions from the UN Council. We have a Security Council that has been with us and just about with us from the beginning. South Korea agreed to harmonize sanctions and join the United States in sanctioning additional rogue actors whose funds have helped North Korea and North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. It's unacceptable to us. the United States welcomed the decision of President Moon to remove the payload restrictions on missiles to combat the North Korean threat. And together, we reaffirmed our commitment to a campaign of maximum pressure. Like Japan, South Korea is increasing its defense contributions. During our meetings, President Moon acknowledged his desire for equitable cost sharing for the United States military forces stationed in South Korea. And I visited soldiers at Camp Humphreys, a brand new joint American-South Korean base paid for almost entirely by the South Korean government. At that base, I discussed with the United States and South Korean military leaders both military options and readiness to respond to North Korean provocation or offensive actions. During our visit, President Moon and I also discussed America's commitment to reducing our trade deficit with South Korea. At my discretion and direction, we are currently renegotiating the disastrous U.S.-Korea trade agreement signed under the previous administration. It has been a disaster for the United States. Last week, 42 South Korean companies announced their intent to invest in projects worth more than $17 billion in the United States, and 24 companies announced plans to purchase $58 billion in American goods and services. From South Korea, Melania and I traveled to China, where, as in Japan and South Korea, we were greatly honored by the splendor of our reception. Our trip included the first official dinner held for a foreign leader in the Forbidden City since the founding of the modern China, where we enjoyed a very productive evening hosted by President Xi and his wonderful wife, Madam Peng. During our visit, President Xi pledged to faithfully implement United Nations Security Council resolutions on North Korea and to use his great economic influence over the regime to achieve our common goal of a denuclearized Korean Peninsula. President Xi recognizes that a nuclear North Korea is a grave threat to China, and we agreed that we would not accept a so-called freeze-for-freeze agreement like those that have consistently failed in the past. We made that time is running out, and we made it clear, and all options remain on the table. I also had a very candid conversation with President Xi about the need to reduce our staggering trade deficit with China and for our trading relationship to be conducted on a truly fair and equitable basis. We can no longer tolerate unfair trading practices that steal American jobs, wealth, and intellectual property. The days of the United States being taken advantage of are over. In China, we also announced $250 billion worth in trade investment deals that will create jobs in the United States. From China, I flew to the city of Da Nang in Vietnam to attend the leaders' meeting for APEC, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. There, I spoke to a major gathering of business leaders where I reminded the world of America's historic role in the Pacific as a force for freedom and for peace. Standing on this proud history, I offered our vision for robust trading relationships in which Indo-Pacific nations can all prosper and grow together. I announced that the United States is ready to make bilateral trade deals with any nation in the region that wants to be our partner in fair and reciprocal trade. We will never again turn a blind eye to trading abuses, to cheating, economic aggression, or anything else from countries that profess a belief in open trade but do not follow the rules or live by its principles themselves. No international trading organization can function if members are allowed to exploit the openness of others for unfair economic gain. Trade abuses harm the United States and its workers, but no more. No more. We will take every trade action necessary to achieve the fair and reciprocal treatment that the United States has offered to the rest of the world for decades. My message has resonated. The 21 APEC leaders, for the first time ever, recognize the importance of fair and reciprocal trade, recognize the need to address unfair trade practices, and acknowledge that the WTO is in strong need of reform. These leaders also noted that countries must do a better job following the rules to which they agree. I also made very clear that the United States will promote a free and open Indo-Pacific in which nations enjoy the independence and respect they deserve. In Vietnam, during a state visit in Hanoi, I also met with President Quan and Prime Minister Phuc to discuss the growing friendship between our countries. Our Vietnamese partners are taking new actions to enforce sanctions on North Korea. In addition, we committed to expand trade and investment between our countries, and we pledge to address the imbalances. I am particularly pleased that the United States and Vietnam recently announced $12 billion in commercial agreements, which will include $10 billion in U.S. content. Finally, I visited the Philippines, where I met with numerous world leaders at the U.S. ASEAN and East Asia summits. At ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, we made it clear that no one owns the ocean. Freedom of navigation and overflight are critical to the security and prosperity of all nations. I also met with the prime ministers of India, Australia, and Japan to discuss our shared commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific. During our visit, President Duterte of the Philippines thanked the American people and our armed forces for supporting the recent liberation of Marawi from ISIS. We pledge to strengthen and deepen our longstanding alliance. At the East Asia Summit, the United States negotiated and signed four important leader statements on the use of chemical weapons, money laundering, poverty alleviation, and countering terrorist propaganda and financing. And crucially, at both summits and throughout the trip, we asked all nations to support our campaign of maximum pressure for North Korean denuclearization. And they are responding by cutting trade with North Korea, restricting financial ties to the regime, and expelling North Korean diplomats and workers. Over the last 2 weeks, we have made historic strides in reasserting American leadership, restoring American security, and reawakening American confidence. Everywhere we went, I reaffirmed our vision for cooperation between proud, independent, and sovereign countries. And I made clear that the United States will be a reliable friend, a strong partner, and a powerful advocate for its own citizens. The momentum from our trip will launch us on our continued effort to accomplish the three core objectives I outlined: to unite the world against North Korean nuclear threat, to promote a free and open Indo-Pacific region, and to advance fair and reciprocal economic relations with our trading partners and allies in the region. We have established a new framework for trade that will ensure reciprocity through enforcement actions, reform of international organizations, and new fair trade deals that benefit the United States and our partners. And we have laid out a pathway toward peace and security in our world where sovereign nations can thrive, flourish, and prosper side by side. This is our beautiful vision for the future. This is a future where this vision, this dream, is only possible if America is strong, proud, and free. As long as we are true to ourselves, faithful to our founding, and loyal to our citizens, then there is no task too great, no dream too large, no goal beyond our reach. My fellow citizens, America is back, and the future has never looked brighter. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all.
Should Roy Moore resign, Mr. President? Do you believe his accusers? Do you believe the accusers of Roy Moore, Mr. President? Should he resign?
You just heard President Donald Trump speaking from the White House about his 12-day trip to Asia. Let's get some quick analysis now from Sung Yoon Lee. He's a professor of Korean studies at Tufts University. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. And just your quick thought, did Asia see the president's trip in the same terms that he just described it as an expression of America being back?
The speech was a bit self-congratulatory. I don't know why the president himself patted himself on the back and announced all these achievements. I think the trip was a success. Now, I don't mean to set the bar low, but there was no open friction expressed, no growling grimaces by either the host nation or the visitor. And in South Korea, which was tricky because the South Korean leader and President Trump have very different views on how to approach the priority problem, how to contain North Korea's growing nuclear missile menace, as President Trump put it. The two men got along, and South Korea was very gracious, hospitable, and President Trump was presidential. His address to the South Korean National Assembly was very consequential in laying out in great detail the multifaceted crimes of the North Korean regime, crimes against humanity like slave labor, the cultish priorities of the regime, the famine, cruel class system, abduction, political prisoners, extreme religious persecution, and so on. So yes, it was a successful trip in that it was the first trip for the U.S. president, and in the past, first trips to Asia have not always gone very smashingly. So I do give President Trump some credit for coming away with at least pledges of reducing the trade deficit for the U.S., that is, at least pledges by the Asian countries of working more closely with the United States on a host of issues.
Professor, tell me, how in sort of material, in a material sense, how different is the Trump administration's position on Asia, let's say Japan, than was the Obama administration's?
Well, when President Obama made his first trip to Asia in late 2009, his stopover in Japan was a disaster. You had a very liberal, so-called progressive prime minister at the time, Hatoyama, who had a slight anti-U.S. Edge to him. And in breach of universal diplomatic protocol, Prime Minister Hatoyama took off for the APEC summit in Singapore while President Obama was still in his own nation, thus indicating that he was a busy man with places to go, whereas President Obama was a tourist. That kind of, you know, open row or discourteous treatment of the visitor did not take place on this trip. President Trump mispronounced Shinzo Abe's last name just now.
Right.
But, you know, the two men obviously have a good rapport. They're very close. I think they genuinely like each other, and that's probably a good thing for maintaining the peace and stability in the region. In China, yes, President Trump was overly fawning. Xi Jinping is, of course, a very powerful leader, but he's also the leader of a dictatorship, a single-party dictatorship with many human rights problems, a nation riddled with human rights violations. President Trump mentioned that President Xi pledged to implement UN Security Council resolutions as if that were an option. Mm-hmm. That suggests that China has not been doing that over the past decade. And China always has pledged to implement, enforce those sanctions and has for the very first few weeks in the aftermath of a major provocation by North Korea. So we're going through that phase again where China does ramp up putting pressure on North Korea. But the question is, for how long?
Well, that is Sung Yoon Lee, professor of Korean studies at Tufts University. Professor, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Professor Lee was providing us some analysis of President Trump's comments just now about his 12-day trip to Asia. The president spoke from the White House. I'd also like to just give a quick thanks to Erica Komisar. We had been, before the president spoke, we'd been talking about her new book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. It was a very spirited and interesting conversation about supporting mothers and families in America. So Erica Komisar, a belated but heartfelt thank you to you. That's it from Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.